Hey everyone, welcome to part two of Ted Bundy, the Lady Killer. I'm your host, DT Cooley. Now, I'll be honest with you, I kind of went back and forth. I thought about waiting till Monday, the next episode airing, to post this part two. But if it was me listening, that would royally piss me off. And I thought, I'm not going to do things that I know would piss me off as a listener. So here we are, part two. If you remember, or if you take a break, basically we're at the part where Ted Bundy had just escaped from prison from jail for the second time. He got all the way down to Tallahassee, Florida. Check my notes so I don't say it wrong. Yep, he made it all the way to Tallahassee, Florida, and booked a room at the Holiday Inn near Florida State University under the alias Chris Hagen. And once again, you're listening to the internet's number one serial killer podcast. I'm DT Cooley, and let's get right into it. Okay, so Bundy rents a room as Chris Hagen at the Holiday Inn near Florida State University campus. Bundy later said that he initially resolved to first find legitimate employment and refrain from further criminal activity, knowing he could probably remain free and undetected in Florida indefinitely as long as he did not attract the attention of police. But his lone job application at a construction site had to be abandoned when he was asked to produce identification. He reverted to his old habits of shoplifting and stealing credit cards from women's wallets left in shopping carts. In the early hours of January 15, 1978, 1 week after his arrival in Tallahassee, Bundy entered FSU's Chi Omega sorority house through a rear door with a faulty locking mechanism. Beginning at 2:45 a.m., he bludgeoned Margaret Bowman, 21, with a piece of oak firewood as she slept, and then garroted her with a nylon stocking. He then entered the bedroom of 20-year-old Lisa Levy and beat her unconscious, strangled her, tore one of her nipples, bit deep into her left buttock, and sexually assaulted her with a hair mist bottle. In an adjoining bedroom, he attacked Kathy Kleiner, breaking her jaw and deeply lacerating her shoulder, and Karen Chandler, who suffered a concussion, broken jaw, loss of teeth, and a crushed finger. Chandler and Kleiner survived the attack. Kleiner later attributed their survival to automobile headlights and illuminated the interior of the room in frightening away the attacker. Tallahassee detectives later determined that the four attacks took place in a total of less than 15 minutes, within earshot of more than 30 witnesses who heard nothing. After leaving the sorority house, Bundy broke into a basement apartment 8 blocks away and attacked FSU student Cheryl Thomas, dislocating her shoulder and fracturing her jaw and skull in 5 places. She was left with permanent deafness and equilibrium damage that ended her dance career. On Thomas's bed, police found semen stain and a pantyhose mask containing 2 hairs, similar to Bundy's in class and characteristic. On February 8th, Bundy drove 150 miles east to Jacksonville in a stolen FSU van. In a parking lot, he approached 14-year-old Leslie Parmenter, the daughter of Jacksonville Police Department's Chief of Detectives, identifying himself as Richard Burton, Fire Department, but retreated when Parmenter's older brother arrived and challenged him. That afternoon, he backtracked 60 miles westward to Lake City. At Lake City Junior High, the following morning, 12-year-old Kimberly Diane Leach was summoned to her homeroom by a teacher to retrieve a forgotten purse. She never returned to class. 7 weeks later, after intensive search, her partially mummified remains were found in a pig farrowing shed near Swain River State Park, 35 miles northwest of Lake City. She appeared to have been raped with her underwear and found near her body containing semen, and killed by violence to the neck with a knife. On February 12th, with insufficient cash to pay his overdue rent and growing suspicion that police were closing in on him, Bundy stole a car and fled Tallahassee, driving westward across Florida Panhandle. 3 days later, around 1 a.m., he was stopped by Pensacola police officer David Lee near the Alabama state line after once again check showed his Volkswagen Beetle was stolen. When told he was under arrest, Bundy kicked Lee's legs out from under him and took off running. Lee fired a warning shot, followed by a second round, gave chase, and tackled him. The two struggled over Lee's gun before the officer finally subdued and arrested Bundy. In the stolen vehicle were three sets of IDs belonging to female FSU students and 21 stolen credit cards and a stolen television set. Also found were a pair of dark-rimmed non-prescription glasses and a pair of plaid slacks, later identified as the disguise, worn by Richard Burton Fire Department in Jacksonville. As Lee transported his subject to jail, unaware that he had just arrested one of FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives, he heard Bundy say, "I wish you had killed me." Following a change of venue to Miami, Bundy stood trial for the Chi Omega homicides and assaults in June 1979. The trial was covered by 250 reporters from five continents and was the first to be televised nationally in the United States. Despite the presence of five court-appointed attorneys, Bundy again handled much of his own defense from the beginning. He sabotaged the entire defense effort out of spite, distress, and delusion, Nelson later wrote. Ted was facing murder charges with a possible death sentence, and all that mattered to him, apparently, was that he be in charge. According to Mike Minerva, a Tallahassee public defender and member of the defense team, a pretrial plea bargain was negotiated in which Bundy would plead guilty to killing Levy, Bowman, and Leach in exchange for a firm 75-year prison sentence. Prosecutors were amenable to a deal by one account because prospects of losing a trial were very good. Bundy, on the other hand, saw the plea deal not only as a means to avoid the death penalty, but also a tactical move. He could enter his plea, then wait 5 years for evidence to disintegrate or become lost, for witnesses to die, move on, and retract their testimony. Once the case against him had deteriorated beyond repair, he could file a post-conviction motion to set aside the plea and secure an acquittal. At the last minute, however, Bundy refused the deal. It made him realize he was going to have to stand in front of the whole world and say he was guilty. Minerva said he just couldn't do it. At the trial, crucial testimony came from Chi Omega sorority members Connie Hastings, who placed Bundy in the vicinity of the Chi Omega house that evening, and Nita Neary, who saw him leaving the sorority house clutching the Oak murder weapon. Incriminating physical evidence, including impressions of the bite wounds Bundy had inflicted on Lisa Levy's left buttock, which forensic odontologist Richard Silverine and Lowell Levine matched to castings of Bundy's teeth. The jury deliberated for less than 7 hours before convicting him on July 24, 1979, of the Bowman and Levy murders. Three counts of attempted first-degree murder for the assault of Kleiner, Chandler, and Thomas, and two counts of burglary. Trial Judge Edwards Colbert imposed death sentences on the murder convictions. Okay, I want to stop here. There is a movie on Netflix, and it's got Zac Efron as playing as Bundy, but there's a part in it at the very end when he's convicted and sentenced to death where the judge says, "This has been a huge waste of human life. You would have been a great attorney. I would have loved to have you in my courtroom." That is true. And I actually looked that up earlier this evening before beginning working on my podcast. And like the judge literally did say that to Bundy as he sentences him to death. 6 months later, a second trial took place in Orlando for the abduction and murder of Kimberly Leach. Bundy was found guilty once again after less than 8 hours deliberation due to principally to the testimony of an eyewitness who saw him leading Leach from the schoolyard to a stolen van. Important material evidence included clothing fibers from an unusual manufacturing error found in the van and on Leach's body, which matched fibers from the jacket Bundy was wearing when he was arrested. During the penal phase of the trial, Bundy took advantage of an obscure Florida law providing that a marriage declaration in court in the presence of a judge constituted as legal marriage. As he was questioning former Washington State DES worker Carol Ann Boone, who had moved to Florida to be near Bundy and testified on behalf of him during both trials, and was again testifying on his behalf as a character witness, he asked her to marry him, she accepted, and Bundy declared to the court that they were legally married. On February 10th, 1980, Bundy was sentenced for a third time to death by electrocution As the sentence was announced, he reportedly stood and shouted, "Tell the jury they were wrong. The third death sentence would be the one that was ultimately carried out 9 years later." In October 1981, Boone gave birth to their daughter, named Bundy as the father. While conjugal visits were not allowed at Rayford Prison, inmates were known to pool their money in order to bribe guards to allow them intimate time alone with female visitors. Shortly after the conclusion of the Leach trial and the beginning of the long appeals process that followed, Bundy initiated a series of interviews with Stephen McCall and Hugh Ainsworth. Speaking mostly in third person to avoid the stigma of confession, he began for the first time to divulge details of his crimes and thought processes. He recounted his career as a thief, confirming Klopfer's long suspicion that he had shoplifted virtually everything of substance that he owned. "The big payoff for me," he said, "was actually possessing whatever it was that I had stolen. I really enjoyed having something that I wanted and got out and taken. Possession proved to be an important motive for rape and murder as well. Sexual assault," he said, "fulfilled his need to totally possess his victims. At first, he killed his victims as a matter of expediency to eliminate the possibility of being caught. But later, murder became part of the adventure. The ultimate possession was, in fact, taking the life," he said, "and then the physical possession of the remains." Bundy also confided in Special Agent William Hagmeyer of the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit. Hagmeyer was struck by the deep, almost mystical satisfaction that Bundy took in murder. He said that, "After a while, murder is not just a crime of lust or violence," Hagmeyer related. "It becomes a possession. They are part of you. The victim becomes a part of you, and you two are forever one. The grounds where you kill them or leave them become sacred to you, and you will always be drawn back to them." Bundy told Hagmeyer that he considered himself to be an amateur or impulsive killer in his early years before moving into what he termed his prime or predator phase at about the time of Linda Healy's murder in 1974. This implied that he began killing but well before 1974, although he never explicitly admitted to having done so. In July 1984, Rayford guards found two hacksaw blades that Bundy had hidden in his cell. A steel bar in one of the cell's windows had been sawed completely through the top and the bottom and glued back in place with homemade soap-based adhesive. Several months later, guards found an unauthorized mirror hidden in the cell, and Bundy was again moved to a different cell. Shortly thereafter, he was charged with a disciplinary infraction for unauthorized correspondence with another high-profile criminal, John Hinckley Jr. In October 1984, Bundy contacted Robert Capel and offered to share his self-proclaimed expertise in serial killer psychology in the ongoing hunt in Washington for the Green River Killer, later identified as Gary Ridgway. Capel and the Green River Task Force detective Dave Reichert interviewed Bundy, but Ridgway remained at large for a further 17 years. Campbell published a detailed documentation of the Green River interviews and later collaborated with McCaud on another examination of the interview material. Bundy coined the nickname "The River Man" for Gary Ridgway, which was later used in the title of Capel's book, The River Man, Ted Bundy and I Hunt for the Green River Killer. In early 1986, an execution date, March 4th, was set for the Chi Omega convictions. The Supreme Court issued a brief stay, but the execution was quickly rescheduled. In April, shortly after the court issued a brief stay, but the In April, shortly after the new date, July 2nd, was announced, Bundy finally confessed to Hagmeyer and Nelson what they believed was a full range of his depredations, including details of what he did to some of his victims after their deaths. He told them he revisited Taylor Mountain, Issaquah, and other secondary crime scenes often several times to lie with his victims and perform sexual acts on their decomposing bodies until putrefaction forced them to stop. In some cases, he drove for several hours each way. He remained the entire night. In Utah, he applied makeup to Melissa Smith's lifeless face and repeatedly washed Laura Ames' hair. "If you've got time," he told Hagmeyer, "they could be anything you want them to be." He decapitated approximately 12 of his victims with a hacksaw and kept at least one group of severed heads, probably four later found in Taylor Mountain, Rancourt, Parks, Ball, and Healy in his apartment for a period of time before disposing of them. Less than 15 hours before the scheduled July 2nd execution, the 11th Court of Appeals stated indefinitely and remanded the Chia Mega case for review on multiple technicalities, including Bundy's mental competency to stand trial. An erroneous instruction by the trial judge during the penalty phase, requiring the jury to break a 6-6 tie between life imprisonment and death penalty, which ultimately were never resolved. A new date, November 18, 1986, was then set to carry out Leach's sentence. The 11th Circuit Court issued a stay on November 17th in mid-1988. The 11th Circuit Court ruled against Bundy. In December, the Supreme Court denied a motion to review the ruling. Within hours of that final denial, a firm execution date of January 24, 1989 was announced. Bundy's journey through the appeals courts had been unusually rapid for a capital murder case. Contrary to popular belief, the courts moved Bundy as fast as they could. Even the prosecutors acknowledged that Bundy's lawyers never employed delaying tactics. Though people everywhere see that the apparent delay in executing the archdemon Ted Bundy was actually on a fast track. With all appeal avenues exhausted, with no further motivation to deny his crimes, Bundy agreed to speak frankly with investigators. He confessed to Capel that he committed all 8 of the Washington and Oregon homicides for which he was the prime suspect. He described 3 additional previously known victims in Washington and 2 in Oregon whom he declined to identify, if indeed he ever even knew their identities. He said he left a 5th corpse, Donna Manson, on Taylor Mountain, but incinerated her head in Klopfer's fireplace. "Of all the things I did to Klopfer," he told Capel, "this is probably the one she is least likely to forgive me for, poor Liz." Bundy described in graphic detail his abduction of Gorgon Hawkins from the brightly lit UW highway, how he lured her to his car, rendering her unconscious with a crowbar he had early placed beside the vehicle. He then handcuffed her and drove her to Issaquah, where he had strangled her, before spending the entire night with her body. He later revisited her corpse on 3 different occasions. He also admitted for the first time that he returned to UW Alley in the morning after Hawkins' abduction and murder. There, in the very midst of a major crime scene investigation, he located and gathered Hawkins' earrings and one of her shoes, where he had left them in an adjoining parking lot, departed unobserved. "It was so feet so brazen," wrote Capel, "that it astonishes police even today." He described the Issaquah crime scene, where the bones of Alt Noslin and Hawkins were found. "It was almost like he was just there," Capel said, "like he was seeing everything. He was infatuated with the idea because he spent so much time there. He is just totally consumed with murder all the time." Nelson's impressions were similar. "It was absolute misogyny of his crimes that stunned me," she wrote. "His manifested rage against women. He had no compassion at all. He was totally engrossed in the details. His murders were his life's accomplishments." Bundy confessed to detectives in Idaho, Utah, and Colorado that he had committed numerous additional homicides, including several that were unknown to the police. He explained that when he was in Utah, he could bring his victims back to his apartment, where he would reenact scenarios depicted in the covers of detective magazines. A new ulterior strategy quickly became apparent. He withheld many details, hoping to parlay the incomplete information into yet another stay of execution. "There are other buried remains in Colorado," he admitted, but refused to elaborate. The immediate strategy, immediately dubbed Ted's Bones for Time scheme, served only to deepen the resolve of authorities to see Bundy executed on schedule and yielded little new detailed information. In cases where he did give details, nothing was found. Colorado Detective Matt Lindvall interpreted this as a conflict between his desire to postpone his execution by divulging information and his need to remain in total possession, the only person who knew the victim's true resting places. When it became clear that there no further stays would be forthcoming from the courts, Bundy's supporters began lobbying for the only remaining option, executing clemency. Diane Weiner, a young Florida attorney and Bundy's last purported love interest, asked the families of several Colorado and Utah victims to petition Florida Governor Bob Martinez for a postponement to give Bundy time to reveal more information. All refused. The families already believed that their victims that the victims were dead and Ted had killed them, wrote Nelson. They didn't need his confession. Martinez made it clear that he would not agree to further delay in any case. We are not going to have the system manipulated, he told reporters. For him to be negotiating for his life over bodies of victims is despicable. Boone had championed Bundy's innocence without all of his trials and felt deeply betrayed by his admission and that he was in fact guilty. She moved back to Washington with her daughter and refused to accept phone calls on the morning of his execution. She was hurt by his relationship with Diana Weiner, Nelson wrote, and devastated by his sudden wholesale confession in his last days. Hagmeier was present during Bundy's final interviews with investigators. On the eve of his execution, he talked of suicide. He did not want to give the state the satisfaction of watching him die, Hagmeier said. Bundy died in Ryford electric chair at 7:16 a.m. Eastern Time on January 24, 1989. Hundreds of revelers sang, danced, and set off fireworks in the pasture across from Bundy's corpse. And they cheered as they watched Bundy's corpse departed from prison in a white hearse. He was cremated in Gainesville and his ashes scattered at an undisclosed location at Cascade Range in Washington State, in accordance to his will. It is said that the reason he asked for his scatters to be scattered there, or his ashes to be scattered there, was because that's where many of his victims lay and he wanted to be with them. So now, I want to take a step back and I want to go over the victim profiles in which Bundy would liked. Bundy was an unusually organized and calculating criminal who used his extensive knowledge of law enforcement methodologies to elude identification and capture for years. His crime scenes were distributed over large geographic areas. His victim count had risen to at least 20 before it became clear that the numerous investigators in widely disparate jurisdictions were hunting the same man. His assault methods of choice were blunt trauma and strangulation, two relatively silent techniques that could be accomplished with common household items. He deliberately avoided firearms due to the noise they made and the ballistics evidence that they left behind. He was a meticulous researcher who explored his surroundings in minute detail, looking for safe sites to seize and dispose his victims. He was unusually skilled at minimizing physical evidence. His fingerprints were never found at the crime scene, nor any other incontrovertible evidence of his guilt. In fact, he repeated often during the years in which he attempted to maintain his innocence. Other significant obstacles for law enforcement were Bundy's generic, essentially anonymous physical features and a curious chameleon-like ability to change his appearance almost at will. Early on, police complained of the futility of showing his photograph to witnesses. He looked different in virtually every photo ever taken of him. In person, his expression would so change his whole appearance, and there were moments you weren't even sure if you were looking at the same person. Bundy was well aware of his unusual quality, and he exploited it using subtle modifications of facial hair or hairstyle to significantly alter his appearance as necessary. He concealed his one distinctive identifying mark, a dark mole on his neck, with turtleneck shirts and sweaters. Even his Volkswagen Beetle proved difficult to pin down. Its color was variously described by witnesses as metallic or non-metallic, tan or bronze, light brown or dark brown. Early on, he consisted of forcibly late-night entry followed by a violent attack with a blunt weapon on a sleeping victim. He left Sparks for dead while Healy was kidnapped. As his methodology evolved, Bundy became progressively more organized in his choice of victims and crime scenes. He would employ various ruses designed to lure his victims to the vicinity of his vehicle, where he had pre-positioned a weapon using a crowbar. In many cases, he wore a plaster cast on one leg or a sling on one arm and sometimes hobbled on crutches, then requested assistance in carrying something to his vehicle. Bundy was regarded as handsome, charismatic, which, like I said, he used to exploit these to lure his female victims. His secondary sites, he would remove and later burn the victim's clothing, or at least one case, deposit them in Goodwill Industries collection bins. Bundy explained that the clothing removal was ritualistic, but also in a practical matter, as it minimized the chance of leaving trace evidence at the crime scene that could implicate him. Which, as we know, it was actually a manufacturing error from his jacket that ultimately got him charged with murder. He often revisited his secondary crime scenes to engage in acts of necrophilia and to groom and dress up the cadavers. Some victims were found wearing articles of clothing that they had never worn or nail polish family members had never seen. He took Polaroid photos of many victims. "When you work hard at doing something, you do it right," he told Hagmeier. "You don't want to forget it." Consumption of large quantities of alcohol was an essential component. He told both Keppel and McCaud he needed to be extremely drunk while on the prowl in order to significantly diminish the inhibitions and to sedate the dominant personality that he feared might prevent his inner entity from acting on impulses. Toward the end of his spree in Florida, perhaps under the stress of being a fugitive, he aggressed to indiscriminate attacks on sleeping victims. Bundy underwent many psychiatric examinations. The experts' conclusions varied. Dorothy Ott, now Lewis Professor of Psychiatry at the New York University School of Medicine, and an authority on violent behavior, initially made diagnosis of bipolar disorder, but later changed her impression more than once. She also suggested the possibility of multiple personality disorder based on behaviors described in interviews and court testimony. A great aunt witnessed an episode during which Bundy seemed to turn into another unrecognizable person. Suddenly, inexplicably, found herself afraid of her favorite nephew as they waited together at a dusk-darkened train station. He had turned into a stranger. Lewis recounted a prison official in Tallahassee describing a similar transformation. He said, "He became weird on me, did a metamorphosis, a body and facial change, and felt there was almost an odor emitting from him." He said, "Almost a complete change of personality. That was the day I was afraid of him." If you made it this far, you're awesome. I hope you learned something. Ted Bundy was a crazy, horrible person. I've seen so many where women are so infatuated with him because, you know, Zac Efron portrayed him. And in that movie on Netflix, they didn't really get deep into the horrors that he actually did to these women. So all they saw was a good-looking guy. They played him partly as like a good guy in this movie, and nobody really understood what he was actually like. I mean, especially for my generation, you know, the older generations, they remember when this happened, when all these women were disappearing, and then when he was convicted and then ultimately executed. Just to kind of explain the magnitude of Ted Bundy's killing spree, I wanted to reiterate on all of his killings. Some part to show respect to these victims, some part to educate and let you know just the magnitude of this. In Washington, there were 11 and 3 unidentified. In Utah, there were 8. 3 unidentified. In Colorado, there were 3. In Florida, there were 3. In Oregon, there were 2. Both were unidentified. In Idaho, there were 2. 1 was unidentified. And in California, there was 1 unidentified. Now, researchers and law enforcement believe the number is so much greater than what we know. There's accounts, like I spoke about, I believe in part 1, that he was believed to start killing it early as age 14. But in 1974, on January 4th, Karen Sparks, often identified as Joni Lenz in Bundy literature, age 18, was bludgeoned and sexually assaulted in her bed as she slept. She survived. February 1st, Linda Ann Healy, bludgeoned while asleep and abducted, skull and mandible recovered at Taylor Mountain site. March 12th, Donna Gail Manson, 19, abducted while walking to a concert at the Evergreen State College. Body left, according to Bundy, at Taylor Mountain site, but never found. April 17th, Susan Elaine Rancourt, disappeared after attending an evening advisors meeting at Central Washington College. Skull and mandible recovered at Taylor Mountain site in 1975. May 6th, Roberta Kathleen Parks, vanished from Oregon State University in Corvallis. Skull and mandible recovered at Taylor Mountain site in 1975. Brenda Carol Ball, 22, disappeared after leaving Flame Tavern in Burren. Skull and mandible recovered at Taylor Mountain site in 1975. June 11th, Georgian, often misspelled. I don't know why I left that in there, but Georgian Hawkins, abducted from an alley behind her sorority house. Skeletal remains identified by Bundy as those of Hawkins recovered in Issaquah site. July 14th, Janice Ann Ott, 23, abducted from Lake Sammamish State Park in broad daylight. Skeletal remains recovered in Issaquah site in 1975. July 14th, Dennis Marie Nasland, abducted 4 hours after Ott from the same park. Skeletal remains recovered at Issaquah site in 1975. Utah, Colorado, and Idaho. October 2nd, Nancy Wilcox, ambushed and assaulted, strangled in Holiday. Body buried, according to Bundy, near Capitol Reef National Park, 200 miles south of Salt Lake City, but never found. She was 16. October 18th, Melissa Ann Smith, 17, vanished from Midvale, Utah. Body found 9 days later in nearby mountainous area. October 31st, Laura Ann Aim, disappeared from Lehi, Utah. Bludgeoned and raped. Body discovered by hikers in American Fork Canyon. November 8th, Carol DeRanche, attempted abduction in Murray, Utah. Escaped from Bundy's car and survived. Excuse me. November 8th, Deborah Jean Kent, vanished after leaving a school play in Bountiful, Utah. Body left, according to Bundy, near Fairview, Utah, 100 miles south of Bountiful. Minimal skeletal remains, one patella found eventually in 2015, positively identified by DNA as Kent's. 1975, Utah, Colorado, and Idaho. January 12th, Karen Eileen Campbell, 23, disappeared from a hotel hallway in Snowmass, Colorado. Body discovered 36 days later on a dirt road near the hotel. March 15th, Julie Cunningham, disappeared on her way to a tavern in Vail, Colorado. Body buried, according to Bundy, near Rifle 90, west of Vail, but never found. April 6th, Denise Lynn Oliverson, 25, abducted while cycling to her parents' house in Grand Junction, Colorado. Body thrown, according to Bundy, into Colorado River, 5 miles west of Grand Junction, but never found. May 6th, Lynette Dawn Culver, 12, abducted from Alameda Junior High School in Pocatello, Idaho. Body thrown, according to Bundy, into what authorities believe to be the Snake River, but never found. June 28th, Susan Curtis, 15, disappeared during a youth conference at Brigham Young University. Body buried, according to Bundy, near Price, Utah, 75 miles southeast of Provo, but never found. Florida. January 15th, Margaret Elizabeth Bowman, 21, bludgeoned and then strangled as she slept the Chi Omega sorority, FSU. There was no secondary crime scene. January 15th, Lisa Levy, 20, bludgeoned, strangled, and sexually assaulted as she slept, Chi Omega sorority, FSU, and there was no secondary crime scene. January 15th, Corrine Chandler, 21, bludgeoned as she slept, Chi Omega sorority, and she survived. January 15th, Kathy Kleiner, 21, bludgeoned as she slept, Chi Omega sorority, survived. January 15th, Cheryl Thomas, bludgeoned as she slept, 8 blocks from Chi Omega, survived. February 9th, Kimberly Diane Leach, 12, abducted from junior high school in Lake City, Florida. Mummified remains found near Swain River State Park, 43 miles west of Salt Lake City. And with that, don't crucify me if I say in the Chi or Chi Omega wrong. I was never in a fraternity when I went to college. Or sorority, because I am a dude. Other possible victim. Bundy remains a suspect in several unsolved homicides. Is likely responsible for others that may never be identified. In 1987, he confided to Capel that there were some murders that he would never talk about because they were committed too close to home, too close to a family, or involved victims who were very young. Anne Marie Burr, age 8, vanished from her home in Tacoma on August 31st, 1961, when Bundy was 14. An unknown tennis shoe imprint was found by the overturned bench used to enter the house. Due to the small size of the shoe, police believe the perpetrator to be a teenager or youth. The Burr house was on Bundy's newspaper delivery route. The victim's father was certain that he saw Bundy in a ditch at a construction site on the nearby University of Puget Sound campus in the morning his daughter disappeared. Other circumstantial evidence implicates him as well, but detectives familiar with the case have never agreed on the likelihood of his involvement. Bundy repeatedly denied culpability and wrote a letter of denial to the Burr family in 1986. But Capel has observed that Burr fits all three of Bundy's no discussion categories: too close to home, too close to family, and very young. Forensic testing of material evidence from the Burr crime scene in 2011 yielded insufficient intact DNA sequences for comparison with Bundy's. Flight attendant Lisa E. Wick, Lonnie Reed Trumbull, both 20, were bludgeoned with a piece of lumber as they slept in the basement apartment in Seattle Queen Anne Hill District, June 23rd of 1966, near Safeway store where Bundy worked at the time and where the woman regularly shopped. Trumbull died. In retrospect, Keppel noted many similarities in the Chiamega crime scene. Wick, who suffered permanent memory loss as a result of the attack, later contacted Ann Rule. "I know that it was Ted Bundy who did that to us," she wrote, "but I can't tell you how I know." The absence of incriminating evidence, Bundy's involvement remains speculative. Vacation college friends Susan Margaret Davis and Elizabeth Perry, both 19, were stabbed to death on May 30th, 1969. Their car was found that day abandoned beside the Garden State Parkway outside Summers Point, New Jersey, near Atlantic City, 60 miles southeast of Philadelphia, and their bodies, one nude, one fully clothed, were found nearby the woods, found in nearby woods later that day. Bundy attended Temple University from January through May 1969 and apparently did not move west until after Memorial Day weekend. While Bundy's accounts of his earliest crime scenes vary considerably between interviews, he told forensic psychologist Art Norman that his first murder victims were two women in the Philadelphia area. Biographer Richard Larson believed that Bundy committed the murders using feigned injury ruse based on the investigator's interview with Julia. Bundy's aunt, Ted, she said, was wearing a leg cast due to an automobile accident on the weekend of the homicides and therefore could not have traveled from Philadelphia to Jersey Shore. There is no official record of any such accident. Bundy is considered a strong suspect, but the case remains open. Rita Patricia Curran, a 24-year-old elementary school teacher and part-time motel maid, was murdered in her basement apartment on July 19, 1971 in Burlington, Vermont. She had been strangled, bludgeoned, and raped. The location of the motel where she worked, adjacent to Bundy's birthplace, the Elizabeth Lund home of unwed murders, or unmed mothers, its similarities to known Bundy crime scenes, led retired FBI agent John Bassett to propose him as a suspect. No evidence firmly places Bundy in Burlington on that date, but municipal records note that a person named Bundy was bitten by a dog that week, and long stretches of the Bundy's time, including the summer of 1971, remain unaccounted for. Curran's murder officially remains unsolved. According to Capel, Bundy told him he murdered a young woman July 1971 in Burlington, Vermont, who worked next door to a home for unwed mothers where Bundy was born. Bundy was there to obtain information about his birth. Joyce LePage, 21, was last seen July 22, 1971 on the campus of Washington State University, where she was an undergraduate. 9 months later, her skeletal remains were found wrapped in carpeting military blankets bound with rope in a deep ravine south of Pullman, Washington. Multiple suspects, including Bundy, have never been cleared, according to investigators. Whitman County authorities have said that Bundy remains a suspect. Rita Lorraine Jolly, 17, disappeared from Westland, Oregon on June 29, 1973. Vicki Lynn Holler, 24, disappeared from Eugene, Oregon on August 20, 1973. Bundy confessed to 2 homicides in Oregon without identifying the victims. Oregon detectives suspected that they were Jolly and Holler. but were unable to obtain interview time with Mundy to confirm it. Both women remain classified as missing. Catherine Mary Devine, 14, was abducted on November 25, 1973, and her body was found the next month in the Capitol State Forest near Olympia, Washington. Brenda Joy Baker, 14, was seen hitchhiking near, I'm going to butcher this, Puyallup, Washington, on May 27, 1974. Her body was found in Millersvania State Park a month later. Though Bundy was widely believed responsible for both murders, he told Capel that he had no knowledge of either case. DNA analysis led to the arrest and conviction of William E. Costin for Devine's murder in 2002. The Baker homicide remains unsolved. Sandra Jean Weaver, 19, a Wisconsin native who had been living in Tooele, Utah, was last seen in Salt Lake City on July 1, 1974. Her new body was discovered the following day near Grand Junction, Colorado. Sources conflict on whether Bundy's mentioned Weaver's name during the death row interviews. Her murder remains unsolved. Melanie Suzanne Susie Cooley, 18, disappeared on April 15, 1975 after leaving Netherland High School in Netherland, Colorado, 50 miles northwest of Denver. Her bludgeoned and strangled corpse was discovered by road maintenance workers 2 weeks later in Coal Creek Canyon. Gasoline station receipts placed Bundy in the nearby Golden Day on the day. In nearby Golden on the day that Cooley disappeared. Cooley is included in some compilations of Bundy victims, but Jefferson County authorities say the evidence is inconclusive and continue to treat the homicide as a cold case. Shelley K. Robertson, 24, failed to show up for work in Golden, Colorado on July 1, 1975. Her nude decomposed body was found in August 500 feet inside a mine on Berthoud Pass near Winter Park Resort by two mining students. Gas station receipts placed Bundy in the area at that time, but there is no direct evidence of his involvement. The case remains open. Nancy Perry Baird, 23, disappeared from the service station where she worked in Layton, Utah, 25 miles north of Salt Lake City on July 4, 1975. Remains classified as a missing person. Bundy specifically denied involvement in this case during his death row interviews. Debbie Smith, 17, was last seen in Salt Lake City in early February 1976, shortly before the Durance trial began. Her body was found near Salt Lake City International Airport on April 1, 1976. Though listed as a Bundy victim by some sources, her murder remains officially unsolved. Minutes before his execution, Hagmeier inquired Bundy about unsolved homicides in New Jersey, Illinois, Vermont, Texas, Miami, and Florida. Bundy provided directions, later proven inaccurate, to Susan Curtis's burial site in Utah, but denied involvement in any of the open cases. In 2011, Bundy's complete DNA profile obtained from a vial of blood found in an evidence vault was added to the FBI's DNA database for future reference in these unsolved murder cases. So basically, he was a bad dude, and he killed a lot of women that looked and dressed and had their hair done and everything very similar. He was executed, and now they have a vial of his blood for DNA analysis and further cold cases. I mean, there's been speculation that Bundy has killed upwards of 50 women and that he just didn't talk about it. And if you made it this far, you are awesome because you bore with me. Or you stuck around with me for about an hour and a half, I'd guess. So you're awesome. I love you. And I will see you next time on Monday, in which we're going to be going over the character profile of Jeffrey Dahmer. Which I read a meme the other day that said Jeffrey Dahmer, the people Dahmer. So that's what might be what I named my episode. So you guys have a great weekend. I love y'all, and be safe.